Hi, everybody, and welcome to another special episode of the Kamine Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade, and on this episode, I was joined by Jean Moldenhauer. She's an SME in the sterilization space. She's the vice president at Excellent Pharma Consulting. In this episode, we focus on all things autoclaving. So we talk about steam sterilization, moist and dry heat. We talk about biological and chemical indicators, how and where they're placed, and what it means for the resistance of different organisms. We talk about cycle development and validation for autoclaving. We discuss overkill cycles versus product-specific cycles. And Jean ends off by walking us through the history of parametric release and what it means for the GMP release of products. I hope you enjoy this episode with Jean. And as always, if you are not currently subscribed on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, please hit the subscribe button and let me know if you have any feedback for the show or topics you'd like me to go through. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Jean.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery, so this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
You mentioned PDA, but before PDA even, back in the 40s, 50s, more so the 40s and earlier, there were a lot of people that died from medicines that were being administered, which is what pushed them into starting FDA. And so there was a big push, make drugs safer. And one of the ways to do that is by coming up with ways to get rid of possible contamination. And there were two main focuses. One was improving the quality of water that we use to make liquid drugs, and the other was sterilization. There was some basic knowledge of it back in the olden days because people used to boil things to improve the quality in their minds and things like that. And moist heat is really a derivative of boiling and understanding the properties of steam. And when the PDA was first founded, was it 65 years ago now, I think? One of the areas they focused on was manufacturing science. And so a key component of manufacturing science was moist heat sterilization. So back in the very first technical report they wrote, they focused on the right ways to do sterilization, how to validate it, how to implement it.
You said moist heat over... You didn't mention dry heat.
That was the first technical report was moist heat.
The first one was moist heat. Is dry heat newer in terms of its use?
Not really newer. I don't think it was as widely used because dry heat doesn't work well when you're trying to sterilize liquids. So we knew the liquid medicines were an issue, but we don't. Because it takes so long to do, for a lot of liquid sterilizations, it would kill the liquid as well. It would make it non-functional. For example, a common moist heat cycle is usually less than an hour long. Dry heat cycles are rarely under 5 or 6 hours long at higher temperatures.
Really? 5 to 6 hours?
Yeah, the new tunnels and that are much quicker, but in the we're talking about when these things were being developed, most dry heat sites were used for things like glass sterilization, and they were used old ovens that were 5 or 6 hours long to do the cycle.
And so now are they comparable, or it's still a wide gap?
If you're using a batch oven, they're still long cycles. If you're using a tunnel, tunnels work at higher heats, and at a higher heat, you accumulate lethality quicker. And so have shorter cycles in a tunnel, but much hotter.
Okay, so maybe this is a good question. Depyrogenation versus dry heat oven, because sure. What you're describing as a moving tunnel sounds like a depyrogenation oven.
We call them that because that's what we use them for, but it was still dry heat that accomplished that task. So it's just more a higher heat and a certain set of combination of parameters so that you're killing endotoxin as well. And so it normally corresponds to somewhere around 16 minutes of dry heat lethality to achieve depyrogenation. And there's actually calculations from Michael Akers and some other folks like that where you can calculate the theoretical depyrogenation versus just the common parameter that they use in the EP is F sub H, the heating curve. And at a lower temperature or different time periods, they just accumulate this heating coefficient.
Are endotoxins more resilient than stuff that you would typically kill in sterilization?
Yeah. One log of endotoxin inactivation is like 10 to the, I'm sorry, is like 100 logs of bacterial.
When you say log in this context, you mean? Because I know people say 10 log reduction, but I don't know exactly. I know that's like 10 to the minus 6, but I don't know exactly what.
In logarithms, if I have one cell or 9 cells, that's all log, one log. If I have 11 to 99, that's 2 logs. 101 to 999 is 3 logs. So you're going up by a factor of 10 each time.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so now I understand. So people use the 1 log, 2 log, 3 log as a measurement of the sterilization capability?
That's one of the things they use in calculating the lethality.
Okay, so then this to me is like akin to how I would use CPK.
Correct. Or some, it's in that same context of calculations.
Yeah. Okay. Really cool. So let's move into the contaminants themselves. What are you looking to accomplish when you're going through sterilization?
Okay. What we use most often, it would be very difficult to know how hard it is to kill each and every microorganism. We know there's over 4,000 microorganisms. With all the work they've been doing with the microbiome, they're finding all kinds of organisms we never knew existed. So 4,000 is a very conservative number of how many different microorganisms they are. You wouldn't want to have to test all 4,000 microorganisms to see how heat resistant they are. So we've done a lot of studies over time, and we know what characteristics of microorganisms make them resistant to sterilization. And different microorganisms are more resistant to different types of sterilization. What we learned is that the structure of the bacterial spore, the way it's structured, adds heat resistance to it. And so most commonly people use a Geobacillus sterothermophilus because that spore structure has been shown to be one of the very most resistant to moist heat sterilization. And that's an unusual bug because it's also resistant to dry heat. And they also use it in some other sterilization types as well.
And so now we're talking about biological and chemical indicators, right?
Correct. That we use as a biological indicator because in general, that spore structure is so much more resistant than the other microorganisms out there. So if I have organism from water, it's very unlikely to survive in a sterilization cycle if it kills the VIs, because they don't tolerate high temperatures well.
Understood. I think BIs and CIs fit under validation probably. So maybe we can punt it until we get to that. But it's an interesting point that you make that rather than go and characterize every single microorganism and see how resistant or not it is, the approach has been to try and find a common denominator. And that's what you validate against, something that's really hard to kill, something that typically would give you trouble if you don't have all your ducks in a row from a cycle development point of view. So you wouldn't be able to kill it. If you kill that, you can basically kill anything.
Correct.
Is there anything that eludes you that, for example, if you were not to... Is there any situation where you would be able to kill a BI, but still not meet sterilization?
There are situations like that. If you look in like some of the literature and presentations, I think it was about 10 years ago, there was this whole big to-do about the BIs are becoming more resistant because the BIs were surviving sterilization studies that they did. And there's a basic difference between the US and Europe. And it's not that either one is right or wrong. They focus on how they do sterilization differently. In general, in Europe, their focus is on the physical parameters. If I hit the time and the temperature requirements, I'm always sterile. So they have standard cycles like 121 degrees C for 15 minutes. And that's, so if you do that, it's good enough. The U.S. has always focused on the microorganisms. So the U.S. regulators have always wanted to see, how did you test the biological indicators? How do you know that it was the most resistant organism? And what kind of microbiological studies did you do? Neither one of them is wrong. They both try to achieve the same purpose, but they just have a different focus. And so in the United States, when we saw all these people talking about the biological indicators becoming more resistant, we looked at it differently. It was as the intravenous solutions became more complex, they affected the kill of the biological indicator. And remember, I talked about the spore coat having certain characteristics that made it more heat resistant. Well, it turns out, depending on what kind of biological indicator you're using, the actual composition of the chemicals in the drug solution can affect that resistance. So it can make them more or less resistant. For example, if I put them in with strong chelating agents like citric acid, they may become much less resistant to sterilization than they were when they started. Conversely, certain kinds of biological organisms like Geobacillus stereothermophilus are very affected by monovalent ions. So if they're in simple salt solutions or that, they become way more resistant. So there are solutions that may have started out with a D value or resistance value of 2 minutes. And if I put them in potassium chloride or a strong sodium chloride solution, the resistance may go up to 10 or 11 minutes. So they become 6 times more resistant. And so that's a problem. So some pharmaceutical or large volume parenteral manufacturers went to using a different spore. It used to be called Bacillus coagulans. Today it's called Bacillus smithii. But that organism isn't affected by monovalent ions, it's affected by divalent ions. And we don't use a lot of divalent ions in pharmaceutical products today. So there were fewer solutions that would dramatically change the resistance. And what happens is, as the resistance goes up, it becomes more difficult to sterilize the solution, and you need a lot more lethality to get to that magic 10 to the minus 6 sterility assurance level. So you don't want to artificially create a bad situation by what solution and BI combination you use.
And so, because I've had experience with selecting BIs for, I work on combination products,
I've had experience with selecting BIs where we're trying to ensure that a certain part of a device that's still not exposed to the drug product is sterile. What I'm hearing from you, though, is that when you're sterilizing a drug product, the BI is physically in the solution, whatever solution it is you select.
They prefer that the BI is in direct contact with what you're sterilizing. Because the other thing we learned, and oddly enough, you'd be amazed how much research is done on BIs in the United States, or was done on BIs in the last 40 years. When you put the BI directly in contact, for example, with a rubber stopper, stopper formulation can also change the resistance of the BI. And Sandy Rubio and I published a paper a long time ago, and then Tom Berger and Abbott also did the same things with their BIs, where we directly inoculated the BI on the stoppers, and we started finding out that certain stopper types could make the resistance go up 400%. So it might have started out with a BI resistance of 2, and it became 8 when you put it directly on the stopper. So one of the reasons that people are worried about direct contact of the BI or having data that explains it to you is the surface that the BI is on can also change the resistance of the BI. So just because you start out with a D value or resistance value of 2, doesn't mean it stays 2. It changes and it can become more resistant or less resistant depending on the surface it's in contact with or the solution it's inside of, or whether there's actually moist heat getting to it or if it's dry heat. So for example, when they use the same biological indicator, Geobacillus stereothermophilus, if you have a dry heat portion of your piece of equipment or that you're sterilizing, and there's not steam getting to it, it becomes way more resistant. And you'll think that the BIs are surviving because you have a bad cycle, and it's just they're not getting moist heat.
And that's actually the exact situation that I was working where we were trying to figure out which surface was best to demonstrate that the sterilization got to where it needed to, but also at the same time didn't create that confounding that you may see just because it's in contact with something that's making it harder to keep. We'll talk a little bit more about BIs when we get to validation, but as far as environment goes with terminal sterilization, is there any less stringency because you're going to be using terminal sterilization on the environment? Or is it all the same going in? Because I've seen some companies, for example, do aseptic fill and then terminal sterilization.
Okay. For a true moist heat sterilization cycle, they have the most stringent cycle is what they call overkill. And then there's other ones where they talk like product-specific cycles. In an overkill cycle, you don't really have to have aseptic filling. There's no real need for it, because the cycle delivers so much heat lethality that it kills more than the 10 to the minus 6 sterility assurance level you need, regardless of what's in the environment. Because one of the things that's important is in the environment, we don't have a lot of these super heat resistant biological indicators. In fact, depending on whose data you look at, old data from Dr. Odlog or Dr. Caputo or some of those, Jim Akers, Jim Agalico, the data they have shows that most environmental spores that you would get from the environment have a very low heat resistance. Depending on whose data you look at, it could be from 0.2 minutes of resistance down to 0.02 resistance. We very rarely find environmental isolates that have a high resistance to moist heat. There was only one time in my career that I saw one that had a true high resistance. There was a company in France that had a product that routinely passed spore bioburden testing the way they were doing it. But the product was coming in contaminated to their supply, the company they sold it to in the US. And what we found out is that plant was located near Normandy. And it was funny because we were going crazy trying to figure out why this was happening. And we happened to be coming home from dinner one night, and they were talking about in this area, the sheep had a very high salt concentration. So they used to call it salt lamb or something. I can't remember the exact name they gave it, but it was famous for this lamb. So we went and started testing the well water. The well water was very high in salt content. And the wells, that whole area of France.
Wow.
And because it had a very high salt concentration, the spores there were much more resistant than they would normally be in a normal environment. But in my entire career, that's the only time I saw anything that came anywhere close to having the resistance of a biological indicator.
So you mentioned overkill. Is steam ever used in situations where it's not overkill?
Yes. The ideal situation is there's no heat sensitivity of my product, and I can just give it a long cycle that tells me I go all the way from whatever the contamination is that starts on the product all the way down to 10 to the minus 6 sterility assurance level. And for a lot of people, they try to standardize that in that 121 degrees C for 15 minute cycle that you need for Europe. So that's a convenient whatever, but not all products can withstand that. You may have some sugars in it that caramelize. You may have something in your product that degrades at a certain temperature for time and things like that. So we use some other cycles where we still get to 10 to the minus 6, but we base it on the actual bioburden the product sees. So instead of that heat resistance of the spore, we do extensive studies to evaluate and create a model that says, if I use this D value resistance of half a minute or 3/4 of a minute, that's more than substantial for the bioburden I have in my plant. And I base my calculations to get the 10 to the minus 6 based on that heat resistance value. So I use biological indicators, but I know the relationship between them and the actual bioburden in my plant. And I adjust my parameters appropriately. So for example, maybe I don't inoculate with 10 to the 6 BIs. I go to a lower level and show a 7 log reduction to get to that 10 to the minus 6. And according to PDA in the old days, those used to be called combined biological indicator bioburden-based cycles. Today, they're called product-specific cycles. But they're used quite often for large volume perennials, because a lot of the solutions couldn't withstand an overkill cycle, particularly if you're doing things with higher concentrations of dextrose or other heat sensitive products.
In terms of the standard, okay, before we move on, so it's basically overkill versus product specific cycle, right?
Correct.
Those are the distinctions?
Yes.
What are the standard cycles that are broadly accepted? You mentioned that EU is more
EU, yeah, the focused. The pharmacopoeia talks about 121 degrees C for at least 15 minutes.
I thought that there's a lower temperature one for a longer period of time. It was like, I don't remember what it was, but it was like maybe 100 C for 40 minutes.
There are some that use 115 degree cycles. They could be anywhere from 30 to 45 minutes, depending on how you set them up. They often use those like for plastic pour bottles, because the plastic is the rate limiting factor, deformation of the deforming the plastic containers. So you have to do a lower temperature for a longer period of time. But if you're worried about the chemistry of the solution, a better option is to go to a higher temperature for a shorter time, because there's something called the Z value, and that tells you how much kill you need based on temperature. So I get a log difference of kill if I have a Z value of 10 and I cook it at 10 degrees higher. So for every log I kill at 121 degrees C, if I heat it to 131 degrees C, I kill 10 logs per minute instead of one.
And then it's a push-pull exercise between how much heat can it withstand versus how long can it withstand it. And so,
and what container it's in and what it's going on. So you play with these calculations.
Is it ever favorable that it could withstand more heat for a shorter time?
Oh, it happens quite often. We had some cycles during over the course of my career where we had a 300-degree temperature, 300-degree centigrade temperature for less than a minute and killed everything.
300?
That was one. It was a crazy one. But more often, we use around 130 degrees because most steam sterilizers can do 121 cycles and 131 cycles. So if you're buying a standard sterilizer, those are usually the options you have more so. 115, 121, 131. And that's typically in the range of commercial sterilizers we buy. Really hot was a special piece of equipment that we built ourselves.
Sure. And so you can get to sterility in 1 minute.
Yes. I probably add a safety factor and do two, but yeah.
And the 121C is obviously the 15-minute. 131 is how long typically you've seen?
A few minutes.
Okay.
So very short.
Less than five?
Usually. It's like even ourselves, you can go out in 115-degree temperature in Las Vegas for a short period of time. And you maybe don't get sunburned, you don't get these other problems. But if you stayed out there for a long time, it would be a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. 105, you may last 10 minutes. 95, you'd last a half hour and so on.
Same concept.
In terms of the actual cycle, what parameters feed into for dry heat? I imagine it's just heat and time, right? Is there a pressure?
Biological resistance. Not so much pressure, but the biological indicator resistance. When they talk about D values, a D value of 2 minutes, it tells me how resistant the biological indicator is. If I'm in moist heat and I know I'm starting out with 10 to the sixth or 1 million BIs to challenge my cycle, and I have to get down to 10 to the minus six, say my heat resistance D value is 2 minutes. If I start at 10 to the 6 and I have to get to 10 to the minus 6, I have to kill 12 logs. It kills one log for every 2 minutes. I need a minimum FO of 24 to kill 12 logs. If I start out with a bioburden count of 0.
FO?
That's, if you think of when you're a little kid and you learn centigrade is to Fahrenheit as 5 is to 9 plus 32. O is a way of calculating what the equivalent heat history would be if it ran at a specific temperature the whole time. You know, when you see your sterilizer, it doesn't always stay at 121.0 the whole time. It might go a little. Yeah. That calculation of FO tells you what it would be if it stayed at exactly 121 for the whole time period. I might have a few minutes that are higher, some that are lower. What would it be if it stayed at the exact temperature? And FO, by definition, what it would be if it stayed at exactly 121 or 121.1, however you're doing the calculation, with a value of 10 minutes, 10 degrees C. And it tells you how much, you know, what that equivalent value is.
And so you're saying that with, I guess what I'm looking at is if I were to do a DOE on a cycle and see which cycle works best from just a process engineering point of view, manufacturing point of view, I'd want to know what parameters could have impact. And I think what you're saying is I'm looking at it in the wrong way as far as sterilization goes. And the resistance of what I'm trying to kill matters the most.
If you want no biological indicator positives, the BI resistance matters the most. So you need to understand what affects the BI resistance, which would be things like whether it's moist heat or dry heat. Just as a rule of thumb, the heat resistance goes up as about 400% by not having moist heat. So if it's the steam isn't penetrating, the resistance is about 400% higher.
And so,
and it also is affected by what surface, it's also affected by what surface it's on.
Sure.
And what biological indicator it is. Because again, I was telling you a difference about B. smithii versus Bacillus, Geobacillus stereothermophilus. They're affected differently by the surfaces because there's different things that affect the spore coat structure, which gives it its resistance.
And so in terms of the, so that's interesting. So you're saying it, what would affect the BI resistance is the surface, the BI itself, whether the moist heat is actually getting to it or not, whether you're using moist versus dry heat. But in terms of the cycle itself, the levers that you have to change to address that resistance in the sterilizer, what are they?
You want to develop what they call a sterilization model. What am I, is my requirement to get to 10 to the minus 6 sterility assurance level? Generally, it is, because all the regulators tend to require that. There's some exceptions for some products where you combine aseptic filling with terminal sterilization, but I know I need to be 10 to the minus 6. For example, if I have a heat resistant product where I have a lower, it can only take a lower F sub zero. A regulator may say, I'll accept that lower F sub zero, but you have to aseptically fill it too. That isn't the reason most people aseptically fill before sterilization, but it is a reason you could aseptically fill before sterilization. A lot of people just aseptically fill because that's what their plant is designed to do. And they don't want separate rooms for terminally sterilized products.
And so when you said the exception, have you seen that both on the drug and the device side?
Yes, because of combination products.
Yeah.
Not so much devices by themselves, but for combination products. And we don't have a lot of devices that are moist heat sterilized.
Sure, but that's the context I'm asking. And have you seen it for combination products where, for example...
Well, yeah, because you have a solution that drives that issue. The solid sterilization. One of the products that's almost always heat sensitive is high concentration dextroses. So if I'm doing a 50% or 70% dextrose and it can't take a high temperature for a short time, I usually have to sterilize it in a product. Instead of overkill, I'll do a product specific cycle. And maybe for that product specific cycle, I can show that with the parameters I have for bioburden of the product, I can only need FO 4 minutes. Instead of the 12 or 15 minutes that you have in an overkill cycle. And so when you start talking about that low A combination, a lot of regulators are more comfortable if you aseptically fill it before it adds some value to it.
Interesting. And so
basically what they use the aseptic filling for is reduce, making sure you have a very low bioburden. Which yeah. Then means I only need like a 6 log reduction to get to that 10 to the minus 6.
Yeah, sure. It's wiping off a plate that was already relatively clean versus
starting from spaghetti.
As I was going to say, spaghetti, actually. Okay, so the let's focus on steam, but the parameters are what? Temperature,
normally,
obviously.
Temperature. Sure. And pressure is a hard one because if you have too much pressure, you can end up with dry heat. That's when they things like when they call it superheated or that. The combination of temperature and pressure are important. And you need to understand on a steam table where you're at to make sure you're not overheating it with too much pressure. Because that causes, like I said, areas with dry heat. But it's normally temperature, pressure, and time.
And the actual cycle itself, does it, I forget what the word is that I've heard sterilization people use, but that it goes through...
stages?
No, it's a different word. It's used in the gas sterilization.
Phases?
It's a very technical word that I've only heard in that context, but basically the entrance of the gas into the, because gas is a surface sterilant, right? Entrance of the gas into the chamber, it's withdrawal, reentrance of more gas, withdrawal. I forget what the word is. I'll have to maybe meditate on it. But phases, stages, it fulfills the purpose. Does that same thing happen with steam, or it's all just?
No, with stages as well, because you have to, that killing power, you have to be up, the product that you want to sterilize has to be up to that temperature that you're using as the lethality. So if it's supposed to be up at 121, you've got to get the product up to 121. So there's always a heat up phase to get both the chamber to 121 and the product to 121. And there may be an equilibration.
I was going to say, how do you know that the product has reached a temperature?
We put penetration probes in it for validation so that we know the cycle is designed to routinely heat up the product as well.
And so when you're is the parameter product temperature or chamber temperature?
Well, it's both. There's requirements for the chamber temperature and product temperature. There's normally not a requirement that says the product has to be 121, but if it's not at 121, you're not accumulating F sub O at the same rate. And so you're not getting the lethality you need. So we use the F sub zero calculation to evaluate, did that product get hot enough to give you that equivalent heat history?
And you would look at probably where the worst case area that...
Hot and cold spots in the load.
Hot and cold spots. Okay.
If you have a really well-designed sterilizer, you may not be talking about more than a degree difference for the whole sterilizer.
Is that right? They're that sensitive.
Yeah, and they're that expensive. Cost comes precision.
Can you talk about parametric release?
Sure. And Baxter always, when I worked at Baxter, was always interested in being a low-cost provider. We had a budget of how much sterilization could cost for our IV solutions. And we also were in a hurry to release all our products. There's always a concern for product release. It took 14 days to get product released after you finished the sterilization cycle. And if you were a microbiologist, the wording you heard, no matter where you worked, was the sterility test holds up product release, because it was a 14-day test. And if you were the microbiologist, you always learned that you were the bad guys at any company because you held up product release. And so one of the things was that we were accused of holding a product release. But the other thing that started happening in the mid-50s was there was a lot of published literature about the sterility test doesn't do what you think. Most people believe that if there was a single contaminant in a product, that you would detect it with the sterility test. And unfortunately, that's a major fallacy. It's really a gross contamination test. You can't even see contaminants in a qualitative sterility test until they're up around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 cells in there, if you're lucky, to actually visualize it in the test. So you're not going to find single contaminants. There's also a thing that low-level microorganisms evidently don't like being hermits, so they tend instead to die off rather than thrive. So you could have, if it was really low-level contamination, you wouldn't show it. Because of that, they started doing a lot of this testing, and we found that a lot of organisms didn't grow under the conditions of the sterility test. And Bryce and Dr. White are among the leaders that published a lot of this information in the 50s. And so one of the issues is that the test we do is not statistically valid by any stretch of the imagination. You can't detect the organisms, not all organisms.
Is it 20? It's N equals 20 for sterility?
Yes. And you can't detect the organisms. It's a qualitative test, pass, fail. Not all organisms grow at the conditions. And there's one organism that's always our favorite to use for deficiency of the sterility testing, Campylobacter faecali. It's a bug that is fatal to infants quite often when they get it. And you would never, ever detect it in the sterility test because it only grows at 40 degrees C. And we don't test at 40. We test at 20 to 25 and 30 to 35. And so that was those kinds of things. The sterility test isn't telling you what you think it is. Yet in court, we're held to a standard. You think that it detects every single contaminant. Dr. Peter Cooney, who was the head of micro review for FDA on the drug side, he was in an open FDA live meeting, and he once said that it ought to be renamed the gross contamination test. So anyway, there was a lot of concern about the invalidity of the sterility test. And what really controls the sterility of the product is the product controls and manufacturing controls we have in place. So in 1980, Baxter was the first company that did a submission to show that if you control all those parameters, you know, tightly controlled limits, your product would always pass the sterility test. And they called that parametric release. And they got approved, I believe it's 1983. And you would think that all the other companies rushed to do it. And it was 15 years before the next company got approval.
Wow. Is that because they wouldn't approve it or because they
No, it got approved in the first pass.
Yeah, but nobody, I'm saying that.
I think they didn't. Baxter worked a long time to get all the sterilizers to meet the same set of manufacturing process controls. I spent a lot of time and money into doing that so that all the sterilizers looked alike, worked alike, that you had consistency across sterilizers and that. It was a big project. They invested a lot of money in it. The more interesting thing was, of course, everybody thought, oh, at the end of the 14-day sterility test, you know, we can release product the same day. And what they really found out is that the sterility test wasn't the only thing holding up product release. But I give them credit because The last product release time I found, the last time I've heard a presentation from them where they talked about product release time, they were down to five or six hours from the end of filling, able to release product. So you had to address how you handle deviations and investigations, the chemistry testing and whatever. You have to look at it as a holistic program to get the real benefits of parametric release. But I remember back in $1980, it was like around a $3 million savings or cost avoidance by not having to hold it in the warehouse for those 14 days.
Yeah. And so a couple things on that. It sounds like where people hold the sterility test to be the gold standard, in my head before I was thinking parametric release is something you need to demonstrate, obviously, a significant amount of evidence to show that the parameters equal sterility. But it also sounds like you're saying doing parametric release is the opposite holds true. Parametric release is in some ways
is a tighter control,
is a more gold standard than using a sterility test. That doesn't seem, I should say, in my limited subjective experience, that doesn't seem to be the way that most people think about it. I think still the sterility test is perceived as a gold standard. Is that right? Or is it just that?
Well, I'll tell you what happened at this meeting. I'll tell you what happened at this meeting where Dr. Cooney made the gross contamination thing and that it didn't detect every single organism in it. There's a big committee that was, I can't remember what the exact title of it is, but there's a pharmaceutical committee of predominantly pharmacists and PhDs and stuff that advised FDA. They were shocked when he made that comment because they just didn't know that. So I think a lot of it is lack of knowledge. I don't think people realize the limitations of the sterility test. And it's well published in that. Somehow I never went and looked up and said, hey, what can we do to do a sterility test better? You just assume that if you label it sterile, it means there's absolutely nothing in it. The labeling something sterile only means it passes the USP or EP sterility test. Now, fortunately, we have very high standards and tight controls in manufacturing. So I'm not remotely suggesting that all the products on the market are contaminated.
Sure.
But it's really being controlled by the manufacturing process controls more so than the sterility test results.
Is steam, what in your experience, and I know it's subjective for sure, but the products that you've seen, what is the split difference between, is it mostly moist heat that you're, is it like 80% moist heat, 20% dry heat, or is one used more than the other, or is it like 50-50?
What's really interesting is, like I said, as of the 2020 survey they did, more than 80% of all pharmaceuticals are still aseptically filled. People have been resistant to switching to terminal sterilization because of the level of work done. But moist heat is most commonly used for liquid products and vials and things like that. One of the biggest reasons is that a lot of them can't withstand the high temperatures of dry heat. And it may also deform the containers. We do a lot of things in plastic containers of various types and size for solutions. And most plastic containers can't withstand some of the temperatures in that. On the device side, it's predominantly gaseous sterilization. Dry heat, for the most part, in most of the world, as far as I know, is predominantly used for things like glass sterilization. Now, either because it has to be depyrogenated in a depyrogenation tunnel, so they're using dry heat to accomplish that, or batch ovens to accomplish it.
So it's mostly moist heat.
Correct. Until you get into things like gas and radiation for non-liquid products.
Well, very good. Where can people find you, Gene?
My website is XL Pharma, with two at CELLPHARMA.com or .net.
Very good. Gene Moldenhauer, thanks for coming on. This was great.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.